Yeah, I'm here. I won't even play any mandolin on this whole thing.
You can play a little at the end.
Let me know. Just give me like a cool like hand sign when it's time to do an interstitial. Like maybe like not the okay sign. That's rude. Like in the studio, you're like behind the class and you're just giving me the thumbs up. Like, you ever listen to the song Maggot Brain?
By Funkadelic?
Yeah. You know that fucking solo that he nails at the beginning? Apparently the producer was like, he's like, what am I supposed to play on guitar here to start this song off? He's like, I don't care what you're playing, man. Just play it like your mama just died. And then he just fucking hits that solo, like first take, just fucking nails it. That's what I want you. I want you to be that producer giving me a thumbs up from behind the glass when you want an interstitial.
Yeah, but if you mess up the solo, I'm going to give you a thumbs down. Stroke or no stroke, that's no excuse.
Yeah, that's fine. I just watched Gladiator the other day, so the stakes of that are really high. I had to watch Gladiator 1, you know, to see what all the hype's about with Gladiator 2.
Yeah, I enjoy that alternate history of the proletarian revolution in ancient Rome. But how are you doing, Sean? Let's give the listeners a little update. You're apparently moved on from being bedridden with a stroke to playing funk on the mandolin.
Yeah, yeah, you got to play funk on the mandolin. No, I'm okay. I watched Gladiator. My brother was in town to watch over me. That was nice. In physical therapy, apparently last time I was on, I had a bit of like a droopy drawl thing going on. I think I've lost that. They've been working me pretty hard in physical therapy, so that's good.
Mm-hmm.
Got my sight back. By and large, like 90%, I can see again, which is great. I can walk again, walking the dog. Ready to go back to work, but looking at like a month maybe or so.
That's great. Power levels restoring.
Restoring.
That is awesome news.
Yeah, I feel good about it.
And I'm sorry you couldn't be with me here today at Antifada Studios in Ridgewood, Queens, but we do have a guest, Liz Pelly.
Hello.
Thanks for joining us. And Liz Pelly is the author of Mood Machine, The Rise of Spotify and the Costs of the Perfect Playlist. And so, as you can see by my tasteful and classy, illustrious studio, you're surrounded by vinyl records. And that's the only way I consume music. I don't care for CDs and, you know, MP3s and all this stuff. So you're going to have to inform, and I think Sean's the same way. He's even more of a hipster when it comes to records. So you'll have to inform us what Spotify is.
Oh yeah, right. Sure. Well, first, thanks for having me. I'm glad that both of you are doing okay. Yeah. And yeah, it's nice to see you.
Oh yeah, Andy too has a health update. Andy got hit by a car.
Yeah, I got hit by a car on my bike, and I have a broken wrist. Can't talk too much about that, but I'm doing good.
Yeah, glad you guys are okay. Happy to speak with you. What is Spotify? I can explain that. Spotify is a music streaming service. A streaming service is a arrangement where music is stored on a central server, and instead of having music like locally on your computer, you pay every month to have a subscription where you can stream a library of music from a, you know, central server that is run by a media company.
So it's like a reservoir, and then these sort of irrigation streams of the music come trickling out.
Yeah, I feel like, you know, that's one way you could think about it. And like, obviously, the companies that run these services have to get the rights to license all of the music to make it available. So there's kind of like, I feel like streaming services are, you know, software, they're technology, but then they're also business arrangements. So it's interesting because, you know, like, the concept of having a bunch of files stored on a central server and then a bunch of people connecting to it and accessing those files and streaming them on their computer, like, in and of itself, you know, like, is not necessarily, I think, anything particularly like dubious. And I think there's like ways that you could kind of like reimagine that really basic technological arrangement to be like totally fine. But you know, these are also businesses and they have to license the music. And when they license the music from various rights holders, those contracts come with like all sorts of stipulations about, okay, well, if you have all of our universal music and you have all of our music available to your subscribers for $10 a month, like here's the way you are and aren't away, are not allowed to use it. Here's how much money you have to pay us. So if, you know, streaming services like Spotify end up paying like most of the money that they make to the major labels, so then they have to figure out other ways to make money. So these are also like advertising companies, they're data collection companies, they're selling data to various like marketing companies and data brokers and coming up with all sorts of ways that they can improve their margins by screwing over musicians and listeners.
Okay. Well, interesting.
I like the analogy, like the hydrological analogy there. And I agree with you that there's nothing necessarily or like inherently bad about this technology, but we know that like in hydrological terms, this sort of like centralized reservoir or canal system does lead to like an Asiatic mode of production and some sort of tyranny. I think the tyranny in this case is a familiar tyranny, like the age of records and CDs had a type of corporate tyranny that was the commodity, like the physical commodity of music, bought and sold, decentralized, sent out to record players across the nation, across the world. Now we have like an infinitely reproducible commodity in the MP3, in the digital music sphere. And now this seems like the form that that commodity takes that's most conducive to profits and most conducive to ensuring that the IP owners get something out of like a commodity that has less and less value by the day as processing power increases. Very, very interesting stuff. Like reading your articles in the Baffler and just your work on Spotify in general makes me realize how much of a different world we're in music-wise and commodity-wise than, say, the world that Andy and I grew up with. Maybe all three of us grew up with, maybe many of the listeners grew up with too, in the DIY scene, collecting vinyl, collecting CDs, especially when CDs first became a thing. Some of us remember when massive billions and billions upon billions of dollars were made by the record labels in the transition from vinyl and tape to CD, right? These were boom times. That wasn't even that long ago, like 2-3 decades ago. What a different world we're in now.
Yeah, so that's a good place to start it off, because I think I first met you, Liz, at the Silent Barn, which was a really great DIY venue in Bushwick, not too far from where I got into my bike accident, actually. And you mentioned briefly in the intro that your background in DIY was sort of the impetus for exploring this subject. So how does your background in the DIY scene influence your line of inquiry in this book?
Yeah, for sure. So like you mentioned, I kind of have like two sort of backgrounds that I feel like kind of are parallel but the same, which is like one is like I have a background as a journalist. So like I've been writing about music since I was a teenager, for the local alt weekly, like growing up on Long Island. And then I, started freelancing when I was in college and like worked at an alt weekly newspaper in Boston for a while and ran a music blog and like freelanced for all these different publications. So I've like, you know, had a whole like background as a journalist, but then kind of like at the same time, I've been involved in like, you know, underground music since I was a teenager also, local music scenes, where I grew up, and then getting, really into like college radio and house shows and, living at like various houses where I've thrown shows over the years. And, kind of like being involved in the house show scene in Boston kind of like brought me to Silent Barn, where I lived and was a collective member and worked for like 4-ish years. And I think like part of being involved in underground and independent music, like inherently sort of, you know, involves questioning centers of power in music and not just like thinking about this question of like, you know, if you're saying independent music, then like independent from what does it mean? So they're like questions that have been important to me for a long time. But around the time that I started writing about Spotify and streaming, I think like on one hand, I had been writing about music for a while and was just sort of trying to like think of ways to kind of like bring more like hard reporting into like what I was doing as a music journalist. So I literally wrote down like a bunch of story ideas one day, and like Spotify playlists was one of them. And then I was just constantly surrounded by musicians. Like every day, you know, I worked at Silent Barn as like I booked shows and worked door and bartended and, you know, worked there many nights of the week. It was like it shows many nights of the week. And it was a time where I felt like I was constantly just having conversations with people about how the digital economy of music was changing. And it was an interesting space because like all sorts of people hung out there, like, you know, a lot of like punks hung out there, but then like people who ran independent record labels would be there sometimes too. And like I would like talk to like music journalists, but then also like, you know, people super involved in more underground stuff. And it seemed like it was also this sort of thing that all these people with different backgrounds and who came from different like practices and scenes in music also like were all kind of interested in. It was kind of that. And then also, you know, one of my friends just who worked in the music business, like I was talking to her about this idea and she was like, oh yeah, you should research, you know, this specific aspect of how major labels are influencing playlists, and kind of like helped set me on the path to the first piece.
Yeah. And I was joking before that I don't know what Spotify is. Of course, we all know what Spotify is. I'm actually one of the few people who's banned from Spotify. And maybe we can get into that a little bit later, that story, maybe if we have time for a bonus. But
Andy's using the algorithm.
I think it was a political banning, actually. But
Luigi Mangione of Spotify.
Well, we'll tease that for later.
For the podcast side, like, was it related to podcast stuff?
Yeah.
Oh, wow. I'm going to perp walk you.
But
headquarters to get punished.
It was something of a soft ban. But let's stay focused on the background of Spotify here, because, you know, like you said, this book has a lot of hard reporting, and you come out of it, you know, you talk to a lot of sources at Spotify and a lot of musicians as well. And yeah, you'll definitely come out of it knowing a lot more about Spotify than you ever thought about, which is important because Spotify is such a central way that the music and increasingly the culture industry in general operates now. And so just remembering, go ahead, Sean.
You guys know, I'm just saying I've never used Spotify, not once.
That's awesome.
Based. I managed to dodge the whole thing. It might sound based, but it's just because like that particular moment in time and that particular moment in my life, I just never picked the thing up. I'm vaguely familiar with it, but yeah.
A lot of people are probably listening to this on Spotify right now.
Hell yeah. Welcome, Spotify people. You're subverting the algorithm.
By the end of this episode, you will delete your account. So something that intrigued me about Spotify when I first heard of it, when I first started using it, was it gave you the ability to make a modern version of what us elder millennials call the mixtape. And I remember thinking when I first used Spotify that there, you know, it takes something out of it, the ritual of, you know, taking all of the music that you physically own and dubbing it onto a tape or ripping it onto a CD and putting the tracks in order and making a cute little label for your crush or your friends. And I thought, well, there's a trade-off there, which is that you don't have to own or download all of this music. You can just, it's all there for you, not literally everything, but millions and millions of songs. And so you can make an infinite amount of mixtapes and give it to an infinite amount of people, whoever has the account. And this aspect of Spotify quickly became its sort of central feature, the playlist, and it became a target of the major industrial restructuring of the of music. So talk a little bit about how that DIY mixtape became the curated playlist.
Yeah, well, I think that like they're totally different undertakings, like the concept of a mixtape and the concept of a playlist. So something that always comes to mind when I'm thinking about the difference between them is just like how a mixtape and what you think of when you think of like a mixtape culturally or like in the popular imagination is this just like idea of one person making something for one other person. You know, it's like a one-to-one exchange, or like if you're trying to like communicate a message to someone or like do something special for someone, or like, you know, or you're just trying to introduce your friend to some new music, like, you know, one of the best ways to discover new music is just like asking your friend to make you a mix, you know, like time tested, can't go wrong. Like it's like one of the best ways to find out about new music. But
mother approved. I remember back in the day, like everyone had a cassette player in their car. And so when something new and cool came out, you would take your cassette and you would record it off the vinyl or off the CD and onto the tape. And then everyone would drive around in their car and listen to it. Alternately, and this is a fun thing too, you'd stay up late at night with the boombox and you'd wait until like Z100, the song came on, and you'd press record on the thing and you'd steal the, you pirate the movie, that the music that way. And then you'd listen to your car and the whole thing. So like mixtapes, yeah, it was a very personal thing. It was a very material thing.
Yeah. And there, yeah, like you mentioned, like, you know, there's also this whole other aspect of the history of mixtape culture and tapes in general that's sort of like really antagonistic to the music business. You know, a way of sharing and releasing music that, you know, is kind of in some ways like connected to the history of bootlegging and pirating. But, you know, when you think about like, and also I highly recommend this book that Mark Masters published that came out last year about the history of the cassette tape, called High Bias. If anyone listening is interested in the history of tapes, I'm like a huge tape head. Like I listen to records, but I don't have a massive record collection, but I do have like floor to ceiling cassettes in my apartment. It's like my like favorite way of listening to music, for lots of reasons.
They're also pretty cool.
Yeah, it's just like also so much more accessible. Like if you go to shows like multiple nights a week and you want to like support the bands you're seeing or like buy something at the merch table, like oftentimes a tape will be like $5 or $7, where these days vinyl is like can be like $30. It's like if you're thinking about like the economy of new music, it's so much more accessible to yeah, like buy tapes then. And it's also a lot easier to make them. Like you can like make a small run of tapes for like $300 if you're like $200 or $300 if you're like a band just starting out. So
and it was part, it was like tapes were part and parcel of like an entire material culture, which included VHS tapes too, right? Which was another huge way to pirate. You know, you'd wait and for the I don't know, Iron Eagle 3 to come out on like NBC, and you'd record it on VHS tape and you'd like very assiduously make sure you get the commercials out of it, you know. Or you go down to the video store and the enterprising people would have two VCRs and you could use the one VCR to record like straight from the video store, the VHS onto the other one. And then you would pass tapes around, you know, stolen tapes. It's back when like piracy was, you would still get the FBI notice about the piracy on every VHS tape that you rented from the store, but there was really no proof. There was no like way for them to track you back to your home. There was no like digital imprint of this thing, where privacy obviously became a huge concern. We remember Napster, late 90s, early 2000s, and Metallica, right? Piracy becomes something different, I feel like, when you move them from the material culture of taping, cassette tapes, VHS tapes, into the digital culture of MP3s, Napster, and all that stuff.
Yeah, the way I describe it in my book is that, like, you know, there's this whole history of bootlegging, even in the vinyl era, of home taping, and music piracy, like pre-Napster, but that Napster sort of like took piracy mainstream in some ways, or, you know, if you want to call it piracy or file sharing or like whatever term you want to use to describe it. But it was kind of like a moment when it was, yeah, like mainstream in a new way. Like, you know, sometimes I think about it, like music became really central to my life in the Napster era, like probably a lot of other people who are listening who are, mm-hmm. You know, of a similar age. And sometimes it's like wild to think about like, oh yeah, I was like a 12-year-old, like, and I like knew what Napster, you know, like it's wild that it had that reach. Like,
yeah, I remember when I was a kid trying to get into ska just through searching Napster. And that, so I would search the ska category and I found a lot of good ska that way, of course, but sometimes things would just be mislabeled. So one of the things I downloaded as ska was the Smiths, the boy with a thorn in his side. And so when I first heard the Smiths, I was like, this is the worst ska band I've ever heard.
Terrible.
they don't even know what ska is. Yeah. They're posers.
That's really funny. I guess
this was something, I'm sorry, that struck me reading about, you know, reading your work on Spotify, especially when it comes to like the corporate data mined like mood playlists, mm-hmm. that you discussed in your Baffler piece. I believe it's Big Mood Machine.
Mm-hmm.
How much of like, especially early to mid 90s DIY sort of punk culture was specifically about avoiding this, you know, in a mm-hmm. different era, avoiding MTV, avoiding big record labels, the sense of like taste, or this sense of like an ambient sort of mood, an ambient feeling, an ambient politics, even sort of being like bashed into your skull by a big evil corporation. Well, now like the big evil corporations play second fiddle to like the new big evil corporations. And I don't know what still stands in DIY culture, because back in the day it was sort of like a pseudo communism, like a pseudo community where like your discernment and your taste and your judgment, your ability to find things pre-Napster or even within the Napster era was like considered like the hallmark of your ability to like create situations, create events, create music, create community, you know, create some basis for like people coming together around this art, around this scene, you know. Nowadays it seems like with everything available all the time, you know, there's no more discernment left, right? Like all of us now can just search ska in Spotify and it's going to get us Toots and the Maytals, it's going to get us like Trojan Records, like all the coolest shit, you know, that back in the day you had to be shuffling through bins of Generation Records for, you know, as we were all doing in the 90s and the 2000s. Just some general comments on like how, I guess maybe alienating this entire sort of project of Spotify and its combination with Ad Age sort of PR, sort of data mining stuff, how alienating it is from like a certain perspective, like a Gen X or older millennial sort of hipster or punk rock conception of what music is, what it's meant to be, what a scene is supposed to be, what, you know, what any of it's supposed to mean.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, totally. And I guess like just to close the loop on what I was saying earlier about like the difference between mixtapes and playlists too, it's like, I feel like it can seem sort of like not such a big deal, like a lot of people to use these platforms if like, you know, the way that you're engaging with it is like kind of has the feeling of being similar to like making mixtapes. Like if you're just like, oh, I just like, you know, I don't use the recommendations, I just like listen to whatever I want and I like make my own playlist and blah, blah, blah. But it's all kind of like, you know, I write in my book about how the playlists that you make are kind of like the training data for like the AI playlists that they make too. So like, even if it's something that feels personal and intimate, like, you know, when every time you make a playlist and call it like, you know, call it something and give it a description and put 10 or 20 tracks on it, you're kind of like, yeah, contributing to kind of like the basis upon which, you know, this kind of flattening is happening. And it is kind of, I think, like a creeping thing where it is easy for it to not feel like this big shift or cultural shift like in the moment, but then you get like 20 years into the streaming era and look back and you realize that like you're describing, like, yeah, like a really big shift has happened.
Yeah. So getting back to that question, how was it that the DIY playlist, the user generated playlist, became such a crucial element of how the music industry like pushed its new artists, or how Spotify generates its profit?
Yeah. So the user generated playlists were part of Spotify from the beginning, like in the early days of Spotify and other streaming services too. Like, but what I can talk specifically about is Spotify. It was really the experience of using the platform was a lot more focused on the search bar. So like it wasn't really this like hyper curated platform. It was basically just like a library that you could search and make your own playlists. And if you wanted to like get recommendations for what to listen to, you could like listen to your friends' playlists or like find playlists made by other users by searching. But it was kind of more what some people in the music industry have described to me as a wild west of playlisting. And then it was really only around like 2013. So Spotify launched in Europe in 2008 and launched in the United States in 2011. And it was really like after launching in the United States where there was a lot more competition and a lot more like need to grow its user base that it kind of started leaning more into the idea of repositioning itself as a curated service. So like introducing playlists created by Spotify. You know, in 2013, they bought this company called Tunigo, and that was like a playlist company, a playlist app on Spotify. On Spotify, like there used to be third-party apps. So they brought in like this whole team of professional playlist curators. And then 2014, they bought this like big data for music company called Echo Nest and introduced a lot more like algorithmic personalization. And if you look at the way like the company themselves would describe it, it was kind of like the opportunity became less kind of like providing this repository of music that people could search. And it became more about like knowing your music taste better than you know it yourself and providing the perfect playlist for the perfect moment and kind of like, you know, trying to collect data to pinpoint you as a listener and try to just like always be providing like the perfect playlist at the perfect moment. And in doing that, you know, that relies a lot on user-generated playlists because that's like the one of the main forms of data that I have, like to sort of suck in and create these algorithmic recommendations is obviously all your listening data and behavioral data and some data about the music itself. But then it's also like a lot of playlist data. So like every time you make a playlist and call it like dinner playlist, like you're contributing to the training data used to create like dinner mix, that's bought or stuff like that.
And they sort of frame this as a democratic, like a new democratic moment in the music industry because it, I guess I'll sort of combine two questions here. One, I was really impressed by how this history of how Spotify came as sort of a way of controlling this piracy movement that was especially strong in Sweden. You interview Dennis Lixon from the band Refused and International Noise Conspiracy, who is a part of this piracy movement that was very strong in Sweden. And I guess the U.S. was sort of coming after Sweden for like harboring this, for becoming a den of piracy in the Pirate Bay and that sort of thing. And Spotify seemed to be something of an innovation in sort of pushing back against file sharing, right?
Yeah, totally. So like, it's like, you know, I think there were so many other streaming companies that came before Spotify. Also, like, they certainly did not, like, invent the idea of music streaming. There were, like, in the post-Napster years, like, the music industry was freaking out and trying to figure out, like, what do we do about this? And the major labels actually, like, tried to release their own streaming services and, like, failed miserably because they were, like, clunky and you couldn't listen to a lot of music and, like, users sort of rejected it. And then there were other streaming services like Rhapsody and MySpace Music and Pandora and, like, you know, other things. But the one of the reasons why Spotify was successful in Sweden, you know, like what Spotify was trying to offer, which was like a much kind of like different experience than other streaming services, which is they wanted to have a free tier. And the music industry was like really, really opposed to the idea of an ad supported free tier because they were so like, you know, people in the major label music business were like so kind of like anti-Napster and like kind of like trying to sort of end the era of music piracy, and like the idea anything that was like free, like, you know, was like an automatic no sort of thing. And obviously these companies would all need to license their music in order for a streaming service to exist. So the only reason why like the labels and the music business sort of agreed for something like Spotify with a free tier supported by ads to exist was because piracy was like so bad in Sweden, or, you know, considered to be like such a bad problem that as like various sources explained to me, like Sweden was considered by the music business to be a lost market, and they were like, well, there's no hope in ever like recovering the music industry in Sweden, so like, yeah, we'll try anything. And they like allow, you know, so they gave Spotify the licenses needed to do this like free tier streaming service, and then, you know, they were able to like prove that they could like bring people in on the free tier and then move them to the paid tier, and kind of like grew from there, I guess. But yeah, it was really interesting like learning about the history of piracy in Sweden, and not just like how popular piracy was in Sweden, but like how, you know, how much public support there was for it, like by like the public and like government and media institutions and stuff. Like, it wasn't even just like piracy is popular. There was like a real public debate that like actually piracy might be like good for culture, and like it might be actually like something that people are entitled to, or like, you know, it wasn't a given that like this is something that must be stopped. Whereas the kind of really intense sort of like criminalization of piracy and the enforcement of really, really strict copyright law, you know, taking individual, like in the Napster era, there were all these like famous cases of individual music fans being sued and fined thousands of dollars. Like, this like really harsh enforcement of piracy was something that was thought to have been like exported by the United States around the world. And yeah, I kind of like talk about this in my book, but there was even this moment where like the United States like threatened to like impose trade sanctions on Sweden if they didn't like shut down the Pirate Bay.
Yeah, and there's still some of those tensions, I think, with China now about IP. But it's so fascinating to think about how, you know, you could even frame it as like this culture war between like the Swedish hardcore punk scene and like the Pirate Party, which became like kind of a legit political party that still exists throughout Europe, and then the United States, and then Spotify kind of comes to the scene as this sort of pseudo-democratic compromise between the two, where it's like, well, you can listen to all this stuff for free and you can make your own playlist for free. And there's this other democratic pretense to it, which is that the data that you generate and the way you interact with the songs, if you skip it, if you go back to an artist on the playlist, that artist will be compensated more or get a higher profile. What was the, you know, how would you evaluate that kind of marketing or that kind of concept of Spotify?
Yeah, how would you evaluate that? And then I'd just like to jump in to point out a couple historical ironies. The first, of course, being like Sweden's social democratic welfare state, I believe, is the one that subsidizes musicians and artists, right? So there's like an irony of like the very particular political economy of Sweden when it comes to art going back, what, 50 years at this point in time.
Might be a bit in the past tense now.
Yeah.
In the past tense now. But also like a great irony that like this seemingly subversive piratical movement to try to like liberate, you know, this art from the commodity ends up, you know, in a roundabout way, being the sort of seedbed for capital to figure out a way to make like this newly liberated, newly cheapened commodity, capital find a way to like deliver this in a novel way, in a like a globetrotting way, making Spotify like the largest streaming corporation in the entire world when it comes to music. Like it's the piracy itself that forces the capitalists to innovate in this sort of way. So it's like a, you know, if you're going to do half measures like piracy, you're going to end up actually strengthening the corporations at the end of the day, just new ones against the old ones.
Mm. Yeah, totally. And I feel like there's like, you know, a whole other conversation that could be dug up about like the so-called like, you know, free culture movement of like the early 2000s, like actually sort of like giving way to the rise of like, you know, platform giants in a sense, because all of the platforms that we rely on or that are like so in, you know, ingrained in our lives now, like need free content to circulate in order to have like, you know, as Martin Lawrenson from Spotify describes in the book, like he talks about how when they were creating Spotify, they had an advertising product, but they needed a traffic source. And it's like, yeah, music ended up being a traffic source for the advertising models of not just Spotify, but also like YouTube and Facebook and like, you know, all of these other advertising companies. Like music is part of the history of like how these platforms like were able to kind of like ingrain themselves in our lives because it was freely circulating online and easily shared. And yeah, it's like, it's pretty fascinating actually. But you were asking me about like, so the, how Spotify was like kind of this, yeah, like, you know, the way I describe it in my book, talking to like different people who were involved in the piracy scene and pre-Spotify is that like, you know, Spotify was this sort of like so-called like easy solution that like, you know, the music business and like government officials who were like the under all of this like pressure to like find a solution to piracy, like it was something that they could like point to and kind of like served as like a band-aid over these like really tricky conversations that were happening about like copyright and whether music should be free or like, you know, these sort of bigger questions than just like, should musicians have to give their music away like for free, but like, you know, the role of free and accessible culture, like in society that were kind of, I think, yeah, these like interesting conversations that were happening, like the post-Napster, post-piracy era. Spotify kind of in some ways was like a band-aid over all of it. And it's there, I think there was a lot of like sort of like it was really branded with like this sense of like progress and optimism the way other tech companies in that era were. But so the other question about like the way in which Spotify was sort of like positioned as this democratizing force for musicians, I think like came a little bit later when they started sort of like their veering more into kind of like the curatorial role. So like I mentioned, like, yeah, the early days, it was really just sort of like a library and a search bar. But when they started generating their own playlists in 2013, it really came along with this whole narrative that the Spotify playlist was going to be this, you know, alternative to the gatekeepers of the old music industry, like major labels and commercial radio. And because it was all driven by data and how they were, you know, like choosing what songs would be put on their playlists by looking at streaming metrics, and they were just going to, you know, let the fans decide what music like succeeds and lives and dies. It was supposed to be this kind of like, they constantly use this phrase called like leveling the playing field. And Spotify playlists were going to be this like data-driven meritocracy. But obviously, you know, I would say that like in my early reporting on Spotify for like The Baffler, which is where most of my essays in like 2018 and 19 were, maybe like one of the big kind of like projects was that was kind of like debunking the narrative that companies like Spotify were putting forth about being this like democratizing force for culture that was empowering the independent artist, and showing how like actually the relationships between, it was not only the relationships between streaming services and major labels that like hugely influenced what music would become popular on streaming services, but also just like the fact that it often was like certain types of music that like did well in the certain types of playlists that were being championed. And then also there's been more and more like reporting on all these other sorts of like payola schemes and other ways in which it's clearly not a level playing field.
Yeah, and we're all familiar with how artists are getting ripped off in various ways and barely compensated, or if compensated at all. But there's a lot more to this book about how Spotify has shaped culture. And one fascinating dichotomy running through it was the sort of nemesis that Spotify had, the concept of silence. In order for Spotify to maximize streams, they have to get each user to be using it constantly. And as a result, they constantly tend towards background music as a marketing strategy that they are producing the, quote, soundtrack of our lives. And I was struck with this because it's a very profound point about a number of modern afflictions, including main character syndrome, endless consumption, and a deeper dichotomy you discuss, which is between merely hearing music, or, you know, listening to what we once derided as elevator music, and a more profound contemplative act of listening to art, or listening to a song, or listening to a podcast. So a lot of the book describes what Spotify is doing to musicians and their livelihoods, but what is Spotify doing to us as consumers of art and capitalist subjects in general?
Yeah, shout out to Pauline Oliveros and Deep Listening. Highly recommend that one as well. Yeah, you kind of like summarized it really well, I think. You know, a lot of something that I kind of like talk about in the book is how, you know, when I started writing it, I really thought that there was going to be like two sections, or like that the book was going to have like a first half and a second half. Actually, the first time I wrote the book proposal for this book, I wrote it as two different books, like one that was about how streaming was impacting listeners, and like one that was more about like how streaming has impacted musicians. Because on one hand, you have the ways in which like listening, the streaming services kind of encourage this like homogenous listening experience through like algorithmic background playlists. And I do think that, you know, there's this point in the history of Spotify, like according to sources that I interviewed, where they were trying to grow, and they like commissioned a research agency to sort of like do studies on like how people were using the platform, and they realized that like a lot of people actually were just like happy to kind of like pick a playlist and like not really think about anything more than like the mood or vibe or activity of the playlist. And there's kind of this like paradigm that has like emerged over the past decade plus in the music industry called like the lean back listener, or it also gets called like passive listening by the music business. So there, it's not just that like this listening mode exists, because obviously with radio, like, you know, this listening mode has always existed, but it's a real kind of like championing of this mode of listening.
When I'm cleaning the apartment, I put on Herb Albert and the Tijuana Brass, and it's like the perfect music for that. I don't need Spotify to tell me that's what I need to do.
But we're really talking about like the lo-fi chill, lo-fi jazz to study and listen to, lo-fi hip hop, you know, that kind of thing. That's sort of the lean back playlist, right?
Yeah, totally. Because yeah, like, you know, there's a point in the book where I'm like, it totally, like, you know, obviously like people have records they like listening to do while they do certain activities. Like, you know, I have music that I like to listen to during certain times of the year. Like, you might have a record you really associate with like a certain like time frame or thing that you do, or I like to listen to this record when I go running, or like whatever. Like, that's like, you know, yes, like that's one of the roles music plays in our lives.
New York hardcore at the gym.
Yeah, you know, But I think this, you know, mode of listening that has been like really championed by Spotify is more like, yeah, like you said, like, you know, kind of like neo music. And I do talk a bit about like, yeah, the phenomenon of like lo-fi hip hop beats to study and relax to, and chill playlists. And, you know, it's almost kind of like the way in which they call it like functional music in the music business, also like the way in which the music business like treats this type of music almost kind of like demotes like the importance of music like in this role. Whereas like I think that a lot of I don't necessarily think that like it is deserving of that. Anyway, but to close the loop on what I was going to say is like I thought that this story at first was like the story of the rise of the passive listener and then how streaming has impacted like musicians through, you know, like abysmal royalty rates and payola and treating musicians more like content creators and artists and blah, blah, blah. But as I wrote it, I realized like they're actually completely entwined stories, because one of the reasons why it is profitable to streaming services to like have music become like a total background experience is because then it's so much easier to kind of like slip in tracks that are like you know, made by ghost artists and commissioned at a lower royalty rate, or tracks that are kind of like enrolled in these payola like programs. So there's like this program on Spotify called Discovery Mode where an artist can agree to a lower royalty rate in exchange for algorithmic promotion. And if everyone is just like listening to these like background playlists and not really paying attention to what they're listening to, then it's, you know, so much easier for them to kind of just like throw low royalty music into your playlists and you don't notice. And then Spotify can like pay less to artists and return more to themselves. Mm-hmm. So
you just end up with stuff on the playlist that's like by an artist, but then when you go to look it up, it doesn't appear to be a real thing. Maybe it's studio musicians, maybe it's an AI.
Yeah. So like it's two things. It's like and none of this will be disclosed or marked. So like on the platform, it requires kind of like having some sort of media literacy about it and knowing that like, oh, if like I click onto this artist profile and they don't really have a bio, the label listed appears to be like a stock music company, the art looks kind of like it's generated by AI, I can't find any information about this musician anywhere else on the internet, you know, those are all like good signs that it's music that has been created by a production company that maybe has like a licensing deal with Spotify where they get fewer royalties, or maybe it's just like a track that has been made using generative AI by a company that's kind of trying to like juice algorithmic plays. And then also unmarked will be, yeah, like I mentioned, like music that has been enrolled by artists or their labels into these more, you know, so-called like legitimate payola programs. Like, you know, something I talk about in the book is how like in the streaming era, like payola, I think, you know, it refers to a very specific arrangement where it's like an under the table cash payment in exchange for radio play. But Discovery Mode like isn't under the table. It's like there's web, you know, if you Google Spotify Discovery Mode, you'll find the page on their website where they explain what it is and how to enroll in it. And like, right. You know, it's not secretive at all, except that on the platform, tracks that are enrolled in Discovery Mode are not marked. So like you don't know when you have an algorithmic playlist and you're listening through, like you don't know which of these songs are enrolled in mm-hmm. any of these special arrangements.
Yeah. And another thing that was like a big scandal in what, the 50s with like radio stations being exposed for being like DJs being paid to play tracks. That was scandalous in the 50s, but now, you know, why would that be a scandal now?
Yeah, so like it's been totally like normalized, mm-hmm. you know, in OA, and people like, you know, on their Instagram pages like DM for promo kind of thing. It's like, you know, it's not under the table at all. It's like out in the open, and it's happening on streaming services, but also like music industry payola also like, you know, fuels like the whole economy of, yeah, like TikTok and like social media too.
Because Spotify is like a market, right? And if you like, there's a bunch of piggies at that trough. There's a bunch of piggies, just like there's a bunch of piggies at the Grubhub trough with like the ghost kitchens, you know? Mm-hmm. There's a bunch of people trying to game the algorithm. There's a bunch of people trying to make it work. Are the promise of Spotify, just like the promise in the 1950s of DJs as like local talent finders, is that the market's ultimately going to be fair, that like the cream will rise to the top, that like the rock star or the person that makes the artist, I should say, who makes money in this system, or the producers who make money, that arises organically and like spontaneously for the market. And then anything that intercedes in that is like unfair play and it's cheating, you know? I feel like this market of Spotify having greatly devalued the artist, having greatly devalued the commodity that they make, the music that they make, is like almost in a way like a return to the mean. Like it was only with the invention of the phonograph that selling like crystallized art, like crystallized music in this form to be played with like a crystal needle, it became possible for an artist to actually like make a living off of sales of their music in this crystallized form. And that's only like 100-something years ago. So very quickly, like capital as this wrecking ball has like created an entire industry of like crystallized art and destroyed it at the same time, at least from the point of view of the artist. And so I'm not sympathetic to the artist. But the idea that like most of your money would be made from record sales as opposed to like live shows and touring and things of that sort is a very 20th century thing. And so we're reverting to like a pre-phonograph sort of lifestyle if you consider yourself a professional musician and a professional artist. Of course, we could argue that that's not fair, and it probably isn't. These people are putting their heart and soul into their music and they're creating something that's makes the world a better place, and they deserve a living off of that for sure. But I think there's like the old studio system model. There's like the new Spotify, like post piratical model. And then there's like the Sweden, like social democratic, like support your musicians through like tax dollars model. And maybe we haven't really figured out a new one adequate yet to this age, except like get out there and tour, kids.
Yeah, absolutely. And I will say, like, there were definitely moments while writing this book where, like, for full months of my life, I was just deeply on this tip of, like, oh, actually, like, the problem was just, like, recorded music. Like, it should have never been it should have never been invented. Like, music has existed for 35,000 years, and recordings have existed for, like, less than 200 years. Like, wait, like, you know, maybe this was the mistake, actually. Wow.
Becoming Eric Jensen, but for recorded music.
Hey everybody, there's about an hour left of our discussion with Liz Pelly, and if you'd like to hear it, you can hear it for free over at patreon.com/theantifada. You just have to sign up at our free membership tier. You get everything that you get on this free RSS feed, plus access to our Discord community, and while you're over there, why not share some holiday cheer with Sean and I by signing up for $5 a month or annually at a 17% discount? We really appreciate you signing up at that annual level or at any level, or just listening to the show with that free membership over at patreon.com/theantifada. Thanks again for listening, and have a happy holiday season.